Good morning. If you would, please open up your Bibles to the Gospel of John and turn over to chapter 9. We'll start there, but quickly move over to chapter 11. A little bit later this afternoon, we're going to be having the family meeting where the elders have some news they want to share with us, and I'm going to get up and kind of give a report on what's going on with our family and how we're doing, and I think Anna's going to try to be here for that. Looking forward to that. We're coming up on the end of our first year together, and we're very grateful for that year. It's been a good year. What I'd like to do is, there's some things, some Bible passages I'd like us to consider in lieu of the family meeting where I'm going to be talking, but I don't want to preach when I'm talking, so I'm going to do that now. But they're connected. Some of the things that our family would like to share, we're going to do that this morning during the sermon. And we're trying to figure out where to go with that. I believe about a year ago, we shared one lesson on raising a special needs family. I think. I don't have that written down anywhere. But I think we went through some of that. There's actually a three-part lesson that we've done at other congregations where they've asked us to speak on that topic. And we have pictures of the kids and Bible lessons that we've learned from that and that sort of thing. And there are three lessons. And there's just no way, unless you want to be here for like 2 hours, there's no way to get through all of that before the family meeting. And then I started thinking about some of the public Bible readings that we've been doing recently that tie in to that. And I think John chapter 9 does that really well and leads over to some thoughts from John chapter 11. So if you remember, in John chapter 9, Jesus and his disciples encounter a man who's been blind from birth. And it's the cause of a conversation that gets started when the disciples ask a question in verse 2. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And the assumption was that if there was something going wrong in your life, if things were kind of falling apart or you were suffering from some type of malady, that you were experiencing the displeasure of God. So if something was going on, it was up to you to try to track back and figure out, so what was it? Well, what have I done wrong that has made God discipline me this way or punish me this way? How have I failed? And Jesus helps give his disciples a new perspective on that. He challenges their assumptions in verse 3 when he says, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." He goes on to say, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." And so Jesus goes on to help his disciples understand that this man's physical condition was not directly the result of someone's sin, but God was going to use the situation to glorify himself by doing something about it. Doing something about it in this instance meant healing this man of his blindness. Now, what's really neat about John chapter 9 and this particular miracle is that often when Jesus performs a miracle on somebody, we get a couple of verses about it and then we disappear and go on to the next miracle. But with the blind man, you actually get to witness him being interrogated about his healing. You get to hear from his mouth what he thought about that and what he thought about the man who performed the miracle. You don't always get that with miraculous healing. And so in the course of the chapter, you have these religious leaders who decide that Jesus is not who he claims to be. At one point, they question the man had really had a malady at all or whether he had been faking it. They bring the parents in. They question the parents. And eventually, these people who have physical sight reveal that they don't have the spiritual sight to acknowledge who Jesus is. But the man who was born blind, physically blind, has the spiritual sight to acknowledge who Jesus is. And so after he's interrogated, when you get to verse 35, Jesus hears that this man has been cast out. And he finds him and asks him, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And the formerly blind man said, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. It is he who is speaking to you." the blind man who had the spiritual sight to see, who's miraculously been able to see now, is witnessing the Lord who's healed him and who he has placed his faith. Now you track all of that back. The way that God glorified himself in that situation, which was not the man's fault or the parents' fault, was that he ended up revealing and using that scenario to reveal who Jesus was to other people who were paying attention. As we read the gospel, we recognize Jesus was there. That was the Son of God. And you see that duplicated over in John chapter 11. After we read through John chapter 11 a couple of weeks ago in our public reading, there are some things that just kind of stood out to me. I had some questions. I mentioned in our adult class that I mark my Bible with a pen, and people noticed that night I was going crazy, marking things in my text. John chapter 11 records another miracle that John shares with us, and it's the miraculous raising of Lazarus. And the way that that event begins, it starts in verse 1. A certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. Now that has not happened yet. That's yet to happen. But John's making the connection here. So the sister sent to him in verse 3, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." And when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Really, really similar. In chapter 9, you have this man who's been blind his entire life, and his disciples assume his parents had done something wrong or he had sinned. And Jesus says, "No, no, no. But God's allowed this to happen in his sovereignty so that he can reveal how great he is when we heal him." And then you have this friend of Jesus, someone that Jesus had a personal relationship with, who was very ill. And his disciples assumed he's got the news, he's going to go. But Jesus explains, "This illness does not lead to death. It's for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Jesus is going to be glorified through this event. Now, verse 5. Jesus didn't just have a close relationship with Lazarus himself. Verse 5 explains Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, the three siblings Jesus had a close relationship with. And we made this point, we'll make this point again. There are a lot of times in the Gospel of John where folks zero in on that word love. Because when you get to the end of the Gospel of John, in John chapter 21, you have the restoration of Peter, where Jesus repeatedly asks him, "Do you love me?" And Peter says, "Of course I love you." And Jesus says, "Well, feed my sheep." And people in the past have made the point about, well, the first couple of times Jesus is using agape and Peter's using phileo. And the third time Jesus flips it and it breaks Peter's heart. So he says, "Yes, you know I agape you." John uses phileo and agape repeatedly in the Gospel of John interchangeably. And this is one of those places. In verse 3, when it says the sisters sent to him saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill," the word is phileo. When you come down to verse 5, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, the word is agape. He's saying that he loves him, and he loves them. And that's what he's saying. Sometimes I think we make too much out of that. But when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he does something very curious. And he stays where he is for 2 days. A couple of years ago, we got a phone call from Dad that something was going on with Mom, that she wasn't doing well. She was coughing, having a hard time breathing. Took her to the immediate care. Immediate care sent her straight to the ER. She ended up being admitted. And what was going on was she had pneumonia and was experiencing congestive heart failure. What ended up happening was we realized she had contracted some kind of virus that had settled in her heart, that had shut down part of it, that had caused the pneumonia. It was just a spiral. The virus ended up going away. Her heart is 100% recovered. But when we got the call, guess where we wanted to be? Right, like, from here to there. I did not sit back and go, "Well, let's just give it a couple of days." You know, we didn't do that. But Jesus did. Jesus gave it a couple of days. And after this, he turns to the disciples and says, okay, let's go to Judea again. And the disciples say, wait a minute, the Jews are trying to kill you and you want to go back? He said, yeah, we're going to go back. And then in verse 11, he explains one of the reasons that he wants to go back. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. And the disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. But Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. And Thomas, we always give Thomas a hard time because of his hesitancy in believing in the resurrection. Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. The whole group of disciples had a close relationship with Lazarus. Jesus prompts after 2 days, we're going to go down there. And I want to let you know what we're going to find when we get there. In the 2 days that we've stayed here, our friend has died. Now, in verse 17, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, that's counting days in a Jewish time, not necessarily 24-hour days. The text explains that Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. And we need to prepare ourselves for this. Martha and Mary send the message to Jesus to let him know about Lazarus. And the text is asking us to think about, why did they do that? Why did they send the message to Jesus? If your close friend was, from your perspective, the promised Messiah performing miracles that you had witnessed, why would you send the note to Jesus when your brother was sick? The assumption is they sent the message thinking Jesus would come and heal Lazarus. So Jesus walks into town and he meets one sister at a time. And look at how they both respond. In verse 20, when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. And Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. That's why they sent the message. They sent the message to get to Jesus, to try to get him to Bethany to help Lazarus before this happened. But notice what Martha continues to say. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. She still believes that Jesus has the ability to do something. She doesn't put it into words. She says, this is what I had wanted to happen, but I still have faith in you. And Jesus says to her in verse 23, your brother will rise again. And Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. That's a powerful, significant statement. She's declaring Jesus to be the promised Messiah, the Son of God. He's the one who's going to bring salvation. He's the one who's promising resurrection. And then when she finishes with that, Martha goes and tells Mary. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and he's calling for you. Now when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. And when Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him, when the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Same thing that Martha said. The exact same thing. And someone has made this point, and I think it's an appropriate point. Both sisters lost a brother. Both sisters appealed to their Savior to come and help. They both had the desire. They both expressed, look, if you had been here, this would have turned out differently. They both say the same thing up to this point. And someone made the observation, even though you don't see Martha fall down, even though you don't see Martha crying to the degree that Mary is, they're both grieving just in different ways. Martha has a longer, drawn-out, thoughtful discussion with Jesus. She's working through it with words. Mary works through it with tears. I'm not saying there's one right way or one wrong way. They're both working through it. But notice what else Mary has to say. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. In 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. And the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? We've got a connection from 9 and 11 again. They're saying, the man who opened that man's eyes, if he had but been here, don't you think that he could have kept Lazarus from being in that tomb? I want us to stretch a little bit. As we are reading down through this in the public reading, I was marking some things in there, in those verses from 32 to 37. Because we were reading 5-6 chapters that night. And there were some of those phrases that were repeated in other places. For instance, in verse 33, when it says that he was greatly troubled, that phrase is used by John in chapter 12, chapter 13, and twice in chapter 14. This is not the only time that Jesus was greatly troubled. Actually, the couple of times that it's used over in chapter 14, Jesus is praying that his disciples and his followers would not be greatly troubled. And the idea of troubled is something that's agitated. This shot was made famous by the movie Jurassic Park. In Jurassic Park, it was in all of the television advertising where you saw a cup of water and it would vibrate because a dinosaur's foot came down and you'd hear the boom, boom, and you'd see the water. Ooh, ooh. And after Jurassic Park did that, cartoons started doing it, other shows started doing it. They started using this agitated, troubled water to display that something was moving outside. That picture of agitated water is what is used in greatly troubled. There's something moving Jesus. We understand that. We understand that. But what goes on is we assume that he's greatly troubled because of the death of Lazarus. I think there's more going on here. When you get back to deeply moved in his spirit, that phrase is repeated in verse 38. After the people question why did he not save this man or help this man like the blind man, then Jesus deeply moved again. Twice in short succession, Jesus is described as deeply moved in his spirit. Originally, that word for deeply moved described the snort of a horse. You ever seen a horse snort? And it's not the neighing, the really sweet thing. It's the agitated, you know. I can't. And we do that. We kind of huff. We get frustrated. Can't believe that. And that little puff of air reveals that there's something going on inside of us. You know, when mom goes, the kids know to. It's not a good thing when mom huffs, right? Dads do it too. And you put the picture together. In verse 33, Jesus saw Mary weeping. He saw the Jews, the paid mourners, weeping. And he huffed because he was deeply moved in his spirit. And he was greatly troubled. He was agitated on the inside. And then he asks, "Where have you laid him?" Then they tell him, and he cries. And then the Jews interpret his tears. Have you ever had that happen? Where you cry, and somebody assumes to know why you're crying before you've told them anything? You ever had that happen? Someone misreads your tears. They misread your emotions. And you have to tell them, "No, I'm not crying because of this. I'm crying because of this." And that's really confusing, especially to younger children. I mean, they always see tears as always a bad thing. Sometimes tears are because we're so happy tears come out. And the kids are like, "Mom's happy?" Yes. When babies are born, people cry. It's just such an emotional moment, but they're happy the baby was born. Verse 36 is the Jews' interpretation of Jesus' tears. And then on the heels of that, some questioned his thinking, his reasoning, his timing. Why didn't Jesus do for Lazarus what he did for the blind man? And when that question is asked, Jesus is deeply moved again. And then commences to make three statements that result with the resurrection of Lazarus. In verse 39, he tells them to take away the stone. And in verse 43, he tells Lazarus to come walking out. And when Lazarus comes walking out, wrapped up in the clothing of the burial, Jesus commands, "Unbind him, let him go. Death doesn't cling to this guy anymore." But let's go back to verses 33 through 38. And what's going on there? And what does that have to do with anything? Where's the sermon going? I think verses 33 through 38 are the main point of the chapter. And I think it's similar to what happened with the blind man in chapter 9. What did the healing of the blind man result in ultimately? Revealing that Jesus was the Son of God. And the blind man came to faith in him. Think about some of the things that these people have said about Jesus. Martha says, "I believe you're the Christ, you're the Son of God who's coming into the world." Both Mary and Martha, they sent this message assuming that Jesus could come and do something about it because of who they believed him to be. But then when Jesus gets there, no one acts like they believe that he's able to do what he's able to do. They're all questioning. They're crying. Jesus has said, he's already told his disciples, "Look, this illness is going to glorify God." But he gets there and nobody is acting like it. Even though he gave them advance warning. Imagine that. I mean, what if you were a doctor that was walking into a room of people that were mourning the illness of somebody and you were able to do something and you had been telling them, "Look, I can help, I can do this," and you walk into the room and they just kind of crowd you out and ignore that you're in the room. How would that make you feel? Maybe a little agitated inside? Or make you go, "Don't you realize I'm right here?" Jesus was in their midst. And they didn't fully recognize him as being there. And maybe, Jesus was weeping not so much for Lazarus, because he knew what would happen with Lazarus, that he was going to raise him. Maybe Jesus was weeping because people didn't realize that the Son of God was right there in the midst of that mess, and he could do something about it, and they were missing it. He was watching people mourn over something that he could fix instead of rejoicing that he was there to fix it. And it hurt him to see them like that. And what did the raising of Lazarus accomplish when he was raised? Everyone knew he had been dead. You follow the story of Lazarus for the next couple of chapters because people continue to come to faith in Christ because there's a dead man walking around. to the point where the Jews decide we need to kill Lazarus. Not just plot to kill Jesus, we need to get rid of Lazarus. And so while Jesus is bringing life, the religious leaders are plotting death. Now what does that have to do with us? Imagine being the parents of the blind man and asking those questions of yourself. If those were the working assumptions of your day, you would have had the same question in your mind that the disciples did the second that you realized your son was blind. Who sinned? Which one of us messed up? Which one of us failed that our son cannot see? And then to raise him with his disability until he grew to manhood, not knowing or having that conversation with Jesus until Jesus finally healed your son. They worked through all of that. Then you've got Martha and Mary and all the people surrounding them that experienced the loss of someone that they loved very much, including the disciples and Jesus. And even though they're saying the words, "we believe," they don't fully grasp who Jesus is when he's right there. Until he does something about it. And they come to recognize him and come to greater faith in him. There are some things, some lessons that I think we need to take from that. That regardless of the difficulty of your circumstances, whether it's because of some type of malady, whether it's because of some type of disability, whether it's because you're simply experiencing the natural course of living here on earth like Lazarus did, whether it's John chapter 9 or John chapter 11, in both places, Jesus says, look, God has a purpose here, and he's going to glorify himself in this. And he will. I believe that. But in both instances, you also have Jesus who is personally interacting with the blind man, and Jesus who is hurt in John chapter 11 because some of those closest to him don't recognize him for who he is. And they're missing it. Which makes this point, Jesus was right there. Jesus was right there with them. And sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we're distracted from that. But especially for Christians, Jesus is right there. And he's not only right there, as you continue to go through the Gospel of John, and I think this is a neat connection to make. Jesus didn't just raise people from the dead. Jesus experienced death. And do you know who was with him? Who was at the cross? Mary. Who went to the tomb? Mary. Guess what she was doing around the tomb when she realized that it was empty? Crying, expressing grief, similar to this, until Jesus reveals himself to her. Mary just keeps going with Jesus. We need to remember that whatever we're going through, that God has a purpose to glorify himself in that, and that Jesus is right there. They don't have to go through that alone. Mary stuck it out. Mary stuck it out and came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. She didn't just come to believe that he was what she perceived to be the Messiah or the Christ. She came to understand what he really was, the Son of God that came in order to die so that he might be raised. If you die and are raised with him. Talking to somebody about this recently over in Romans chapter 6. If I want the death of Jesus to cover for me, I need to connect with the death of Jesus. I need to die with Christ. I need to die to myself and I need to die to my sin. What Paul explains over in Romans chapter 6 is, I die to those things when I am buried with Christ in baptism. And I'm raised to walk in newness of life. Let's wrap this up. Remember the lesson when we go to talk about what we need to talk about a little bit later tonight. Or this afternoon, not tonight. It's not going to be that late. That whatever we're going through, whether it's my family or your family, God intends to use that to glorify himself. Whether it's healing or whether it's not, God will use it to glorify himself. And what Jesus emphasizes in both John chapter 9 and John chapter 11 is that he is with us. He's with us in the mess. He's with us in the pain. And what we need to be careful of is we're going to be tempted. There are going to be times where we fail to recognize him and we question whether he's there. We don't want to cause him to hurt because we question that. We need to be reminded he's there and have faith and trust that he's there. We need to be connected to his death. We need to be connected to his death. And if you've not done that yet, then we would like you to listen to what Paul says in Romans chapter 6. We would like you to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to die to sin and self, to be raised to walk in newness of life. If there's anybody that has not yet become a Christian, we would like to offer that opportunity this morning. If there's somebody struggling and needing prayers, we want to know and pray with you and for you. If there's anybody that we can assist this morning, let us know by coming to the front rows while we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected for us.